First of all, I just want to give my sincere thanks to the organizers of this meeting. It is an honor and a privilege. Lawyers very seldom get invited anywhere by anyone voluntarily to begin with. But on top of that, to be here in this Cambridge with all of these illustrious people in honor of Bob Edwards is something that is just both an honor and a privilege. I'll just take a minute to say that I have known Bob for many years, and he is one of the most inspirational people that I've ever worked with in the field, especially as a non-scientist. I think what always has struck me about Bob is the scope of his vision and the fact that he always wanted to know how can we make the world better through the science, not just how do we push the science. And I was thinking as I was preparing and looking through old emails how many times I had heard from Martin and others at Reproductive Biomedicine Online with some of the most provocative, timely issues, and how appreciative I am of the work that he has spawned in this area for those of us who are not scientists, because I think that's one of his biggest legacies. I was given the opportunity to pick my topic, and I was thinking initially I would talk about embryos and the legal aspects, but then I decided that was simply depressing because all I would do is tell you that, you know, if the policymakers and the lawyers won over in America and the personhood initiatives won, then everything you did would be illegal and there'd be nothing left for any of you to do. So I thought I should find something a little bit more creative and uplifting to talk about. And so when I started thinking of Bob's substantive legacies, I really think he has created revolutionary challenges to the law. And when I try to conceptualize it, I think of creating ex utero embryos has done a lot of different things. Obviously, it's created novel family building and research possibilities. It's also put out there front and center the need and the challenge to legally define what is an IVF embryo separate from fetuses and pregnancy. Most of the law until the IVF embryo was created was all about reproductive rights and women's bodies, excuse me. It has clearly spawned this entire religious, ethical, and legal debate over life begins, cryopreservation, egg and embryo donation, and then I finally landed on expanding families through gestational surrogacy because, again, it is a family-building technique that could never have happened but for the IVF embryo. So I went searching for pictures of Bob, and everybody has shown some wonderful ones, and the one that struck me was that this pioneering science has really created newly possible families. I know everyone will recognize Bob, Louise Brown, her mother, and her, is it her son, I believe, yes. And so that is what I wanted to focus on, is how we're creating new families through the evolving science. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with the term retronym. I myself had never heard of it until I started doing some research, and it seems to me it is a perfect word that all of us in the field should know. So that just as blocked fallopian tubes created the need for IVF to achieve biological parenthood for some, the inability to carry a pregnancy, coupled with the ability to create IVF embryos, is the only thing that made gestational surrogacy possible. And with that, the birth of retronyms. The retronym is an adjective that now must precede a noun for a word that previously made perfect sense without one makes sense again. So, for example, a color TV didn't have to be said until, black and white TV didn't have to be said until we had color. Analog digital clocks, surrogate mother, biological mother, adoptive mother, gestational mother, genetic mother, and intended mother. Mother has become a word that to me very much needs to go with, is a retronym. So gestational care usually works very well. It doesn't always work exactly as you expect it to. This was first used as a medical treatment for women who could not carry their own children, although they could produce their own embryos. A client of mine, her mother generously stepped forward and said, "Yes, dear, I will carry your child. You have diabetes. This is not a safe thing." She made a reservation at the most romantic restaurant in Atlanta, Georgia, ordered up a bottle of champagne and candles, and said, "Dear, mother has sent a picture of the ultrasound. We are about to see the first picture of our child." She opened the envelope, and out came Dad. This is her father, who scanned himself into the ultrasound of his grandchild because he thought it would be funny. My client was rather upset when she called, and I explained to her that if her father wasn't such a wonderful practical joker, her 52-year-old mother would probably not have been willing to carry a child while being a high school science teacher in the suburbs of Boston and going in every day and saying to her students, "My grandchild, deal with it." So truly, most of these cases are start in love, and they all, for the most part, come out okay. We have happy endings, if not always the exact ones we hope for, but everything doesn't always go right. And so while we're talking about these many legacies of Bob's, I want to talk about IVF made gestational surrogacy possible, and IVF made egg donation and embryo donation possible. And putting them together has made it possible for people who never before thought they could have biological families to have them. So now we have single intended parents who are able to have biological children along with same-sex couples, both male and female, and increasingly in the United States, legally married same-sex couples who therefore get the benefit of a lot of laws that were previously not available to them. And you know, I think there was something fitting about my following the last speaker, because first we talk about what might be or should be, and here I am as the horrible lawyer to tell you about what's happening on the ground. And since we're in an international audience, I also want to invite you afterwards, and very kindly and carefully and sort of sympathetically, if you will, to correct me if I get any of the facts wrong from around the world. Because what I have found in this area is that what you read in the cases in the courts is not always what's actually happening on the ground. So let's look at newly formed international families. The medical advances have given birth to a tremendous number of conflicting national and international laws and policies. I think one of the take-home messages I would give you is that there is little existing consensus and many competing values surrounding surrogacy worldwide. And I'm using surrogacy in the term of gestational surrogacy. We could spend an extra half an hour talking about traditional and gestational, but I'm assuming in this audience we all know gestational means an IVF embryo that's been transferred and the genetic material is not that of the woman who's pregnant, whether it's through donor egg or the intended mother. Remember the retronyms. So in the field of gestational surrogacy, we have a tremendous number of conflicting views, and I think what that has done is given us a pressing need both to recognize and ideally address these differences and the obstacles they're creating, because families are crossing borders continually as they pursue biological parenthood. So the reality on the ground is that art has gone global. According to the HFEA in 2010, reproductive tourism is the most pressing and challenging new development in the arts today. The World Bank has predicted that surrogacy in India alone is going to hit $2.5 billion before the end of this decade. And in 2011, there was a groundbreaking symposium here in England, followed by volume 23, a very special edition of Reproductive Medicine Online, dealing with the social, ethical, policy, and legal issues of cross-border reproductive care. That conference identified four main categories of what they call cross-border reproductive care drivers, if you will. They say that people are driven to cross boundaries for legal and religious prohibitions in their home countries, based on, secondly, for resource considerations, meaning it's too expensive, it takes too long, or art practitioners are not sophisticated enough to handle the medical needs. They travel for quality. They go to countries where the success rates are better and their safety concerns are lower. They go because of personal preferences, where the culture matches their own, where they may have family members who can take them in, and sometimes where they can simply have privacy so that those in their home countries don't know what they're doing, because it often goes against their cultural norms. Why specifically cross-border reproductive care is growing and surrogacy within it, I think, is because we have absolutely discordant laws, norms, and policies. Many countries outlaw surrogacy or IVF altogether. Costa Rica has a case pending right now on whether we're waiting by the day for the courts to decide whether or not outlawing IVF altogether is unconstitutional. Other countries have a policy or religious restrictions on how much care is given. Others restrict who can use their services. In other words, no same-sex couples need apply. We only take traditional couples. Compensation prohibitions are probably one of the biggest drivers of people leaving their own countries, where they can only find compassionate surrogacy. And it's ironic, because the countries like England who have tried to limit compensation, many will tell you that what they've done instead is simply driven their citizens overseas. One of the most interesting articles in that series after the conference was one that talked about the disenfranchisement of citizens who feel that they cannot stay home to take care of their medical needs. Cost drives people. If you just look at what Americans are doing going to India to save money and what others are going, India has become a place where people know you pay your carriers between $4,000 and $6,000 instead of between $25,000 and $35,000. And then we have restrictions on who can be a legal parent and citizenship. These are all creating international dilemmas and policy challenges. I have a lot of cases in here we will not have time to talk about in detail. I'm going to skim through some of the highlights just because I know when I talk to scientists, I better have some data or else they won't believe I know anything about what I'm talking about. So I want to give you a couple of cases. There are German parents we're going to talk about who could not get their twins home from India for 2 years because they used donor egg. And under Germany, the mother was not considered the mother because of the donor egg. Ultimately, they had to literally bend the law in India to get these kids home and allow them to do an in-country adoption, which was prohibited. In the UK, there's a recent case in which the Indian surrogate could not be found. Her consent was required. The court ultimately waived it. A Canadian couple went to pick up their twins in India, had to use DNA to prove they were the genetic parents, and lo and behold, a mistake and or a switch intentionally was made. They were not the biological parents of the twins they were going to pick up. There are problems with couples who choose not to pick up their child. They have an international surrogacy arrangement and something changes. Either the child is born with a genetic anomaly they're not prepared to parent, or something happens in their own lives, a divorce, and they just decide they are not equipped to parent that child. How do you get somebody to come back and pick up their child? The ethical considerations around the costs and who is picking up the medical care costs for these women and children is a huge issue in the U.S. Okay, we are going to do a very, very fast trip through some of the laws that are actually on the books. In Europe, as most of you know, there are legal restrictions, including Belgium, France, Germany, the Netherlands, and Italy on same-sex parents and others. There are donor shortages in countries like the UK, I'm told, although again, on the ground, I'm told that's not as bad as we read about. In the Middle East, there are cultural restrictions. Iran, for example, has cutting-edge ART technology, but no gamete donation. On the ground, one of the answers I'm told is you marry your egg donor for 2 weeks. You bring her into the house with your wife, and she's your second wife. It's no longer egg donation. You get your eggs, you send her packing, and you divorce her. We are not doing egg donation in Iran. There has been a huge uptick in legislation in this field. We're not going to go through all of it, but just look at the dates at the bottom of this slide. Italy in 2005 reversed many of their liberal trends and put in a tremendous number of restrictions. Turkey has revised their ART regulations 2 years ago. Mexico City has their own surrogacy laws they passed. India, I put pending in quotes because, as I understand it, this legislation, which everyone was waiting for, has been pending without much sign of going forward for over 2 years now. In Turkey, two single women, an actress and a single model, went overseas. You had sperm donation. And after having sperm donation, as I understand it, being very public about it, the country changed the laws to say no more. Turkey requires a single embryo transfer for your first IVF cycle for all patients. If you're under 35, you have to have two until your third try. If you're over 35, you can go to two embryos at your second try. The most interesting legal restriction in the field, in my opinion, are the laws that ban travel by a citizen to another country to accomplish medical care not available in their country, and that ban facilitating it. The first, because I don't know how you enforce an extraterritorial law and tell someone they can't do something in a country that's legal if it's not legal in their own country. The second, because it puts everybody who is a medical provider in a very vulnerable position of if they advise their patients about what is good medical care, they can be breaking the law. Turkey actually makes it a first offense. The clinic can be suspended for 2 months. A second offense, their certificate can be yanked altogether, and there's a state prosecutor to whom you are supposed to report any violation. I'm told by one of the participants here last night, as I suspected on the ground, it's not happening exactly that way. On the other hand, there's also a story I was told about a doctor who was traveling, and he's in Cyprus. He sees one of his patients, and he says, "What are you doing here?" And she says, "Look the other way. That group of women and I are all on our way for egg donation, and you don't want to know about it." I'm going to skip some of these and let's just go down. Except the fact that in France and Germany, I'm told a woman must deliver to be the mother. So I was speaking with one of my medical colleagues in the States the other day, and he told me that after he finished delivering her surrogate child in the U.S., he sent her to his favorite plastic surgeon in order to put the most beautiful scar he could on her abdomen so that she could prove that she had, in fact, delivered the child by C-section. And I jokingly said, of course, you did it under the bikini line. He said, oh, no, she needed it right under her waist so she could show it to people very prominently. She's very proud of it, and my colleague did a wonderful job. The United States has its own rules for getting people back in. The bottom line take-home message, I think, is that every country has its own rules, laws, and its own common written and unwritten practices for how it treats its citizens who seek surrogacy treatment abroad. There are restrictions on reentry, citizenship, and legal parentage, all of which tend to impact this field tremendously. So I think when people come to me and other lawyers and say, well, how do I go about dealing with, how do I find the best place to have surrogacy? My non-medical perspective is there are legal issues you have to be aware of. You have to be able to get these children home again. You have to be able to be recognized as their parent and they as citizens of your country. On a more practical level, I think there is a significant issue around things such as medical insurance coverage for the carrier and the child. In the United States, I'm embarrassed to tell you that there are practitioners who will tell their clients, we will not get a birth order for this child, because that way, if there's a problem with the delivery, the surrogate's insurance will consider her to be the mother of the child, her insurance will cover medical costs, and you will not have to worry about it. Now, to me, the ethics of that are absolutely unacceptable. The legal practicalities, people will tell me, are we can't break the bank of our clients. We don't know what else to do. It raises all kinds of questions around professional obligations, ethical standards, and duty of care, and who owes what to whom. I think this is an area in which, across the world, there are very different norms. ESHRI's come out with good practice guidelines that try to facilitate cross-country care. ASRM has recently come out with some. I'll show them to you in a minute as we leave. And then there are international courts struggling with this and the Hague Convention trying to take up surrogacy. I think it will be years before we see anything. We often talk about best interest of the child, but that is a very difficult thing to quantify. So in the UK, as most of you know better than I do, the HFEA regulates surrogacy, making it not illegal, but the surrogate is the legal mother, who has 6 weeks to agree or change her mind, and if she's legally married, her husband is considered the father. You cannot pay beyond reasonable expenses. The laws apply to both in-country and overseas births. This is a very messy slide for which I apologize, but what I found most interesting looking at the HFEA history was that in 1990, consideration of the welfare of the child was included. Something you don't see in the United States and other places because we don't have these types of laws, including the need for a father. 20 years later, it's updated, counseling is required, and supportive parenting language replaces father. 2010 regulations where the child's welfare is now deemed the court's paramount consideration. And as I understand it, the 1985 surrogacy arrangement, which was intended simply to stop professional surrogacy arrangements in the hope of making it more ethical, has in fact resulted in a lot of citizens going abroad, no efficient way of getting birth certificates, and a number of unregulated arrangements. This is something you see time and time again. National laws put into effect to try to keep professional, commercialized surrogacy out and instead simply sends it overseas, and then you're dealing with the question of getting these families home again. A test case here in 2008, a couple hired a Ukrainian surrogate, paid her $35,000. They came back and the court was asked to and agreed to exercise its discretionary power to authorize the arrangement. They did a fairly thoughtful three-part test. Was the sum paid so disproportionate to reasonable expense that offended public policy? Conclusion, no. Were the applicants acting without moral taint in their dealings? Yes. I'm not sure how they concluded that. Were the applicants party to an attempt to defraud the authorities? No. So this was an example of bending the law and giving people what they needed, which was parentage and citizenship for their child. Compare, if you will, the United States. We have no national arts law. Every state has its own laws. Traditional surrogacy is typically unenforceable, whereas gestational surrogacy, we have a very big growing trend toward recognizing these kids. It's state by state. I participated in one of the first cases in our state. It's now become almost pro forma. Whether you are a married heterosexual couple using your own gametes or a same-sex couple using donor gametes or a same-sex couple using none of your own gametes, but you have to be married. Birth orders are necessary to legitimate children, and without them, we have to figure out a healthcare coverage answer that makes sense. The advances in the United States, I would say we are constantly playing catch-up ball. Legal Conceptions is a book that came out, I edited with Dr. Howard Jones, where we tried to look at the 30 years since IVF started and the kinds of legal quandaries it had precipitated. The evolving law and policy of the assisted reproductive technologies was our effort to kind of pinpoint where we thought the cracks and where we thought the fixes were. It was a challenging job, and we haven't finished in the United States, much less on the international level. The questions that people ask, and am I okay on time? I don't have a clock or anything up here. Okay, great. And we are on track. Choosing destinations, for example, Americans will decide they aren't going to come to the U.S. because it's cheaper in India. The ethics of caring for surrogates, the challenges of getting home and establishing parentage are all things that should but don't always go into a calculation before people head overseas to have children. This is a somewhat messy slide, and so I'm just going to simply point out to you that what we tried to do in preparing this was to identify duties of care, which is, from a legal perspective, a highly significant issue. And we have legal standards of care that I think are not clearly articulated or followed with respect to the medical community recognizing that each of these people are their patients when we use third parties, the attorneys who are facilitating these arrangements, and not necessarily recognizing duties of care to these third parties, and the facilitators who are putting these arrangements together without any rules in our country whatsoever. I've spoken to a number of my colleagues who put these together, and I asked them, who do you think you owe a duty of care to? And they say, well, I will get a parentage order, a birth certificate, a passport, and a plane ticket. You, meaning people who come to the U.S. to do this care, you get yourself an attorney in your home country to advise you about citizenship, immigration, parentage at home, essentially whether or not you're going to have a family. I don't think we're trying to just make babies for people. I think we're trying to create families, and those questions have not been answered well. So no matter how we tiptoe around the problem, I say there are some weighty issues that we have to face. And in the U.S., as I said, a lot of it revolves around the medical costs. We do not have a national health service that covers these costs, so people are paying out of pocket. And when international couples come overseas, they are terrified of getting stuck with a multiple birth, high neonatal costs. The insurance options are very minimal, and people often turn to their carrier's own policies, which I think is an unethical end run because it puts them and their own families at risk. So people then head to India. So let's take a few minutes and look at what's happening in India. Carriers are getting $7,000 to $8,000, sometimes less, clinics $25,000. The total cost is probably half of what it is in the U.S. You can get egg donors, sperm donors. You can ship your sperm over as a dad. Some surrogates live at the clinic in group homes. There are more helpers on the internet than you can ever imagine, with some of the most creative names I've ever seen, like We Care Partners, Heartbeats Assisted. Contracts and thumbprints, customs and practices are troublesome. There are stories, repeated stories, of carriers who are illiterate, who do not know how to read, and who are not given someone to interpret the contracts, and who are signing them with their thumbprints. There are women, this is a picture that has gone around the internet many times, women living in group homes. The good news, they say, is they're learning English and getting very good care. The bad news is they're separated from their own children and families. There was a story just a few months ago of an Indian surrogate who, in her 8 months of pregnancy, died. She came in for a routine visit. She was the mother of two young boys. She had what they are calling a health incident, sudden convulsions, collapse, went into cardiac arrest. They did an emergency C-section, and the baby was born healthy. They sent the surrogate to another hospital. They said the ICU unit was better there, and she died. She was supposed to get $4,500. Her family instead was given $18,000, reportedly after pressure. I have no way of knowing whether that's accurate or not. I want to mention very briefly a couple of cases so you can see how the courts have wrestled with these issues. We don't need to go into all the details given our time constraints, but Balaz versus a non-municipality is the German couple I mentioned. They used donor egg and a married Indian surrogate. Their twin boys, look at the date they were born, January 4th, 2008. A mistake, an innocent mistake was made. The birth certificate came out with the 14th instead of the 4th. The wife was put on as the mother, and when they went to correct the birth certificate, the mother was changed to put the Indian surrogate's name on. Germany, therefore, was looking at a situation in which they did not recognize a German mother because motherhood goes through the genetic link. on the birth certificate, it would have appeared the German mother was the mother, but now they knew she was not. They refused to issue visas. The children were not allowed home. India refused Indian citizenship because this was a surrogacy arrangement, and they said their surrogate was not the mother. These kids were in India for 2 years on a standoff. They could not come to a resolution. Ultimately, they bent, and India allowed the couple to adopt within India as an in-country adoption, which is only permitted for an Indian child, and they ignored the fact, finally, this was not an Indian child. Germany then recognized the mother as the adoptive mother, and they were allowed to go home after 2 years. And the court said that they're very concerned about repeats. If I have one of a few take-home messages, it is that the courts are very sympathetic, but they're dealing with a compelling individual case, and it's a terrible way to make policy. British couple hired an Illinois surrogate. The high court here ruled that, yes, they did something wrong, not in Illinois, but they did something wrong here because they paid. But they said the child's welfare should always be the court's paramount consideration, and that to refuse a parental order would be wrong except in the clearest abuse of public policy. I'm told the headlines read, childless couples win the right to pay surrogate mothers, despite all the efforts of the HFEA to do the otherwise. In Belgium, a same-sex male couple went to California. They did absolutely everything right under California law. They got a pre-birth order. They were recognized on the birth certificate. They had beautiful twins. Belgium refused to recognize the California order. The couple sued, thinking they would make landmark litigation. Instead, the court came up with the following conclusion, that they only had to recognize a foreign act under the Code of Private International Law if it was comparable to Belgium law. And what they decided is they had to look at the entire history of the contract, the entire history of the parties. They wanted to see everything. And when they did, they went to the European Convention on Human Rights, and they said no. They said paying a surrogate is difficult to reconcile with human dignity. The contract is, while not prohibited or criminalized, is against the Belgian Civil Code. We will not allow this. Only those things in commerce can be subject of agreements, not babies. The cause is illegal when it is prohibited by law, contrary to good morals and public order. They ultimately said bio-dad can be recognized as the father because he's the biological father, but the non-biological partner has to adopt. At least it didn't get this far. This is a picture, if you look carefully, of two twins who are hidden in the floorboards of a truck and driven across the border by French parents whose kids were being detained in the Ukraine. And they were caught because the kids started crying. This is not the way we want to be making international families. Australia has an interesting paradigm. They also prohibit commercialized surrogacy, but the law allows you to be recognized as a legally responsible parent without legal parentage. So in other words, the kids are protected, but the parents are somewhat punished and have to go through additional steps. Similar to Belgium, a same-sex couple came home and they were in fact granted parentage. Commercial surrogacy is currently under reconsideration in that country for the very reason that they recognize that by prohibiting it, they are not stopping it, they're simply sending it overseas. That brings us to a harder question, which is where is home and who is a parent? And there have been a couple of cases in the United States that are fairly egregious. In one, a pregnant married Carrie, and I referred to this earlier because I became involved in this case, she was carrying donor egg twins for an international couple. The couple divorced. The woman wanted nothing to do with the donor egg twins, and the husband said regretfully, as much as he did love them and want them, it would be better for them to not come home to him as a single dad. Thank you very much anyway. This woman was 6 months pregnant. She no longer had intended parents for these kids. The program that had put them together went looking. They came across my clients who had unsuccessfully attempted gestational surrogacy several times, and they agreed to step in. But they had no genetic connection, and they had no pre-intended connection to the family. So we did what I think in the United States may have been the first in utero adoption. We actually went to the court, explained exactly what had happened, asked for an order of parentage. And then when we got them home to Massachusetts, because that's not where they were born, we did an old-fashioned adoption so that this father, if he changed his mind about wanting his beautiful kids, that he'd sent pictures of himself so they would know what he looked like. In case he changed his mind, we didn't want them to have to worry. There's another egregious case in the United States in which two lawyers thought it was a really nifty idea to start a new surrogacy program. And what they did was they told their carriers they did it a little bit differently. And what they did is they recruited gestational surrogates, flew them to the Ukraine, implanted them with donor embryos, brought them back home again. And once they had an established pregnancy, They then went shopping for parents, and they told unsuspecting intended parents that the carriers were originally matched with terrible people who had backed out, and for $100,000 they could step into the shoes of these missing parents and take these children. They then put fake documents into the court, making it appear that these were the original intended parents. The two lawyers ended up with about a 6-month jail sentence, home confinement, and I understand one of them who ran the surrogacy program turned it over to her husband, who continued to run it. The point being that there are many victims in these areas and very few rules to rely on. ASRM has put out new practice guidelines. I won't go through the details except to say they tried. There's a slight miss here where they said you have to have independent lawyers in every jurisdiction. There's not a lawyer in the United States who is passed a bar in every country that they're working in. The Ethics Committee has draft guidelines under a draft statement that is under review. To me, it's somewhat frightening in what it doesn't do. It says give everyone the same quality of care. Well, I think your international patients may need a higher quality of care. It's not for the doctors to tell them what the law is, but I do think if you're treating international patients with cross-border surrogacy, it behooves you to tell them there are immigration and citizenship and parentage issues that are beyond the scope of the treating physician. We've covered most of this. I want to get close to closing by saying there are evolving perspectives on cross-border care. ESHRI is encouraging countries to work together. I think the standards that they have suggested are wonderful. They would absolutely never work in the United States. The idea of sharing medical records across state lines and with different practices, it was a walking liability issue. We have got other courts looking at this. The Hague is talking about taking up surrogacy, and the reality on the ground, I think, continues to be a challenge. Is there a bottom line? If there is, I think it's that courts want to follow their country's rules, but they aren't comfortable making children parentless and stateless, and they're compromising on an individual basis. I think ultimately the challenge that we face is how to create consistent policies across inconsistent countries' values and laws. How we are going to meet that, I think, is going to be quite difficult. Can we reconcile different values? Can we impact without ignoring the values of the home countries? And I think the best we're going to be able to do on a practical level is minimum standards. How we're going to do that, I think, is as big a challenge as we faced in this field. I will say that while surrogacy is a challenging legacy to try to balance, we are in a global world, and I think it's one of the legacies that Bob has left us to never shy away from the difficult challenges that confront us. He always wanted to help us figure out how to help people with a universal urge to make families, and we have to take into account these different differences while trying to find a framework in which we can make that happen. So I want to close and just thank you for your time and attention, allowing a lawyer to speak and being part of this august body.
Thanks very much, Sue, for guiding us through an incredible minefield there. Some questions, please, from the audience. Jonathan.
The question was, is it true that the United States has a new law that allows birth certificate, parentage orders, birth certificates, and Social Security? No. What is true is that a growing number of states have different mechanisms to recognize legal parentage of intended parents in a surrogacy arrangement. You have to follow the state law. I can talk myself blue into the fact that a birth certificate is a beautiful picture and it looks really nice and it is not parentage. What every couple who tries to do this needs is an order of parentage in accordance with the state where the child is born. So yes, many states will give you those, and if you get those, whether you can get a social security number is going to depend, I think, on whether you're considered a U.S. citizen at birth.
How do you bring children back?
I wish I knew. The only way you bring children back is to follow the law of the country you are trying to come back into. And that was what I was trying to get across, is how this is totally variable. And the United States cannot control that. All the United States can do is give you an order that says you and your wife, if you came over, are the parents. If your country allows you to take your children back with you, which they probably will if you are the genetic intended married parents and a heterosexual couple, you are probably okay. if you are a same-sex couple and you live in Belgium, you are only one of you is okay. You know, so that's the point, is a lot of things that can be done in the United States, even if they're done by the letter of our law, are not adequate in the country to which you're coming. And what I would love to see is every patient who wants to do cross-border surrogacy have a good legal consult and a lawyer telling them that they are safe to both go and come back with their child.
Sounds like a very good recommendation, Susan. Just one further question.
Not a question, just a point of interest that Bob Edwards and Patrick Steptoe, in fact, had Europe's, or in fact the rest of the world outside of America's, first IVF gestational surrogacy baby. In fact, the baby was from Iceland, in fact, and was born in the year that Patrick Steptoe died, I seem to remember. Kay may correct me, but so I just thought, as part of the vision and farsightedness of Bob Edwards and Patrick, they went into surrogacy when it really wasn't very respectable in the UK. So I just thought you'd be interested.
Proving my point that Bob was a visionary on every level in this field.
Thank you very much. So I think, thank you very much,
thank
Susan. We'll move on.